All rise. Chief Judge of the Justice of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near for the court in round session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please take your seats. The court will come to order. Are both sides ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I understand, Mr. Sawada, you want 10 minutes in reserve?
Yes, sir.
All right, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Frank Spinner, and together with Major Spencer Kerr, we represent the appellant, Lieutenant Colonel Stephen DiMaddio, in this case. Let me begin by saying that I don't really intend to spend much time on the sentence appropriateness issue. In fact, I may just make a few comments right up front regarding that and then move into the other two issues. I did ask for oral argument on that issue, in part because Colonel DiMaddio had over 18 years of active duty at the time of trial. He received 11 months confinement in addition to the dismissal. And relative to what the court members found him guilty of and the impact of a dismissal on potential retirement benefits in combination with confinement, it's the appellant's position that this punishment is too severe, and the judge, and we're asking the court, because we can't really obtain relief at this point on from a confinement standpoint, we're asking the court not to approve the dismissal. Next, I would like to address issue number two, which in which there were two challenges for cause against two court members, Colonel Peters and Colonel Andrus. And I would note for the court that one of the cases cited to the court, particularly with respect to Colonel Peters, is United States versus El Fayoumi. And I argued that case at CAF. CAF was a 3-2 vote, and so when I wrote this up as an issue, I recognized that El Fayoumi was out there and that in many respects, and as I anticipated, the governor argued that because of the CAF holding in El Fayoumi, we should not receive relief on Colonel Peters' challenge in this case. But nonetheless, I am raising this issue because I believe that when it comes to homosexuality and military and the turbulence that has developed publicly over this, regarding this issue for a number of years, I think that whenever a member responds during voir dire that they find that homosexuality is immoral and in their view violates their religious beliefs, while there is no per se rule, there shouldn't be a per se rule either way. In other words, there's no per se rule that if they find homosexuality morally offensive under El Fayoumi that they should be, a challenge for cause should be granted. On the other hand, simply because of the holding in El Fayoumi, there's not a reverse per se rule, I guess you would say. In other words, because it was found in El Fayoumi that the judge did not abuse his discretion in denying that challenge, that doesn't mean that this court should just rubber stamp this case as well. And what I see as a significant distinguishing factor in this case with respect to Colonel Peters is that Colonel Peters sat on a discharge board involving, and I believe it was an enlisted member who had made homosexual statements or statements of homosexual tendencies or something of that sort, and that the administrative discharge board that he sat on voted to discharge the service member, which was ultimately apparently overturned at a higher level. I believe that's enough to distinguish the court decision in El Fayoumi, that we can argue or claim now that it was an abuse of discretion for the judge in Colonel DiMaddio's case to deny the challenge for cause.
Are you arguing that Colonel Peters voted for discharge, though?
Well, they didn't clarify that, and I think part of the problem was I'm not sure that you're permitted to discover the vote of a particular board member or court member. In that case, it was a board member. But I don't, my recollection is that it was not disclosed how he voted. It was just that the board voted against it. In my own mind, it probably would have been an improper question to ask him how he personally voted, because I understand it to be a secret vote.
I understand it. So I guess I'm asking you, how can we assume how he voted?
Well, that's the problem that everyone has, is you can't assume that he did, but you can't assume that he didn't. He certainly did not, in his responses during voir dire, disavow the decision of the board or indicate that he disagreed in any way with the decision of the board. So I guess we're just left to argue sort of a reasonable inference when you combine the fact that the board voted to discharge the individual and that in his own personal opinion, homosexuality is immoral. I think it's a fair inference. But there's nothing else I can argue on that point other than to note that it's a secret vote.
All right, I didn't know if I had missed it or...
Well, we're not arguing actual bias in this instance. We're arguing implied bias.
I understand.
And so I think a member of the public, the hypothetical member of the public viewing this process and viewing the questions and the responses would certainly draw that inference. And so from an implied bias standpoint as opposed to actual bias standpoint, I think that combination certainly rises to the level of being an abuse of discretion when the judge denied the challenge for cause.
Didn't in Alfa-Uni the court member characterized his belief as a strong belief that was religiously held, whereas in the case before us, I don't believe the member ever characterized it as a strong belief, merely that it was a moral belief of his, and later on he stated that it was a Christian belief of his, but he never went as far as to characterize it as strong, and moreover, didn't the judge in the case before us go into greater detail in examining the potential bias and determining the member could follow the law?
Yes, I would say that all those things, points you've made, Your Honor, are accurate. I would note, however, that he did say consensual homosexual activity is immoral. And so we're not even, going beyond to obviously a non-consensual situation. But he did say that is his belief. I'm not sure the court can measure how strongly someone holds a belief, whether they express themselves that it was a strongly held belief or not. I don't think there's a meter that says, okay, now you've crossed the line into a strongly held versus that it's...
So it doesn't matter whether they strongly hold a belief or whether that's a belief, but I'm sort of, it's not something I can go to the mat over or whatever.
Right. I mean, we're pretty much bound by the record and the questions that were asked as well as the answers that were given. He did not say it's a strongly held belief, but he did say it's immoral. And for him, it violates his religious faith. And so when we're looking at whether or not a court member can be fair and impartial under the implied bias standard, I think that when he says that consensual homosexuality, which is, the law has changed over time, I think that is, that does show a degree of bias.
But you're in essence arguing almost a per se rule again, which CAF has said they aren't going to have on this.
That's why I clarified. And this, what distinguishes this case from Alfa-Uni is the fact that he sat on a board that discharged an Air Force member. So we have additional facts in this case that did not exist in the Alfa-Uni case. So to be clear, I'm not arguing for a per se rule, and I am distinguishing this case from Alfa-Uni. Additionally...
Why is homosexuality really an issue here, the question? I mean, the charge was for non-consensual, Article 120, but then you have to be male on male.
Right.
But the charge was for non-consensual, not consensual stalking and that type. And the defense is clearly about the case, but this didn't happen. You can't believe the primary victim. So why is homosexuality something we should be...
With all due respect, Your Honor, the defense, while they articulated their primary theory, they basically said, you know, the evidence doesn't fully disclose what went on behind those closed doors, and only two people were present. The concern here, as it was in El-Fayoumi, is that there may have been some kind of consensual homosexual activity that went on behind there. And the possibility that there was a consensual homosexual act of some sort or another, whether initiated by the alleged victim or initiated by Colonel DiMaggio, that evidence didn't rise to the level of supporting the allegations in this case. But that could nonetheless... A person who is biased and believes that homosexuality is immoral, that they could not be fair and impartial in resolving those issues. And it goes not only to the issue of findings, it goes to the issue of punishment as well. I mean, we don't know what Colonel Peters ultimately thought, but he may have voted for an acquittal and just believed that homosexual misconduct occurred, but then he may have voted for a dismissal because he's biased against homosexual consensual conduct. I mean, those are the risks that are inherent and why, under the liberal grant mandated, you know, the judge should have granted the challenge for cause with respect to Colonel Peters. The other thing that I wanted to mention, and this goes back to your question, Judge Weiss, is that point where he made a point of saying he would follow Air Force policy. Now, the judge had asked him about, you know, can you set aside Air Force policy on homosexuality? But then at one point he said that, you know, I can follow the law and Air Force policy. And so that's the kind of response that is problematic, because they certainly seem to be inconsistent. I refer you specifically to page 153 in the record, line 17, and this is pretty much at the end of the inquiry. Colonel Peters says, no, my job is to follow the law and follow the Air Force policy, not to interject my personal belief into the process or into the system. Well, to me, that answer is ambiguous, because if the judge is telling him, follow the law as I instruct you, but don't follow Air Force policy as you understand it on homosexuality, those appear to be inconsistent.
But doesn't the colloquy go on?
Well, yes, it goes on, but this was...
And doesn't he say there's a discrepancy? And the judge says, just not to follow him, and you mentioned to follow Air Force policy, but it's only the law I will instruct you.
Well, right, and sometimes I get concerned about judges rehabilitating court members and winking and nodding in so many words. You know, this is the answer I'm looking for if you want to sit on this panel. Here's why it's problematic. On page 148, the judge instructs him at the beginning of their dialogue, the Air Force and DOD policies regarding homosexuality must be completely disregarded by you. You must decide this case based solely on the evidence presented in the law that I will provide you. Will you be able to follow these instructions? That instruction says, yes, sir. But then on page 153, after some number of pages later, Colonel Peters says, my job is to follow the law and follow the Air Force policy. So if anything, this suggests to me that Colonel Peters really doesn't understand it. Before he told the judge, I understand what you're saying. Now he's saying, no, I don't understand.
But the judge asked him again.
I know. And how can this court be confident in his response, given the fact that he had been asked that question before and said one thing and then later on said something inconsistent with it? Do we just take the last answer he gives?
Well, I think, don't we have to take this as a whole based on all his answers? I mean, the defense counsel himself went into great detail to try to rehabilitate him, it would appear, talking about can't you separate your belief from the individual? And he said he could. And, he talks about here on page 154, so you'll be able to put aside the religious part in deciding this case based solely on United States law. And he says, absolutely, there's no equivocation. Right. And they basically parse this thing out, both the judge and the defense counsel, to in essence get this court member to indicate that he can separate his belief and follow the law. Wouldn't you agree, counsel, that there was a great deal of, more so than even in the Alfamoni case?
I would not agree. What I will agree to is this. This should have been explored more by the court because of the inconsistency in his responses.
I did hear your answer. Explored by more by who?
By the court, the trial court, the judge. Okay. The judge should have developed this record a little bit more fully, and in the absence of doing so, and unless the court has any more questions, this court has any more questions, I think I've stated my position clearly in terms of how I believe this is distinguishable from Alfamoni.
Okay.
The problem with Colonel Andrus is that, there were two parts to the objection with respect to Colonel Andrus. One is that his expertise and that having a potential expert sitting as a court member. I'm not really hanging our argument on that. Our concern more with Colonel Andrus was the fact that he had been involved in preferring charges against an Air Force officer a year or so prior, 2 years prior, and then ultimately had recommended discharge of that individual who did not receive a dismissal, even though he was convicted of some offense, did not receive a dismissal, and so subsequently Colonel Andrus apparently initiated a discharge action, and the officer was discharged.
What's the actual connection between that case and this one? That was a male-female relationship. This one, obviously, you mentioned, is a homosexual one. Commander's doing his job, preferring charges, and starting administrative separation when he thinks it's appropriate. What's the connection to this case?
I think it's more a concern about his candor with the court. I mean, the way I read the defense concern is that, first of all, it wasn't a ministerial act. The judge tried to characterize the preferral of charges as a ministerial act. I don't think, that's not the way I understand ministerial. When a commander prefers charges, he is making a judgment call as to whether or not a probable cause standard has been met. So that's more than ministerial. Obviously, the defense was concerned on two counts here. One was that he had preferred charges and then he had initiated a discharge action against the captain when a dismissal wasn't adjudged. So it's just a pro-government, generalized pro-government bias that they were concerned about. But secondarily, Colonel Andrus was called back because then there was a concern about what he actually recalled about what happened. He seemed to be denying that he did not initiate a discharge action against this captain, when in fact, apparently, he did. And so now you have a problem of candor with the court and whether or not although he claimed to not remember exactly what happened, we did provide an affidavit to the court, which I understand was admitted, has been for the court's consideration. But there was a real question as to whether or not Colonel Andrus was being completely forthright with the court. And so that's a secondary problem with him remaining on the court. Now, at the time, the judge didn't have that affidavit and wasn't aware that Colonel Andrus, in fact, had initiated the discharge action, if the defense counsel for the captain is to be believed. But the inquiry and voir dire suggests that the defense had some information about that and believed that Colonel Andrus was not being entirely truthful or honest about what his involvement was in terms of initiating discharge action. And it was discretionary whether he initiated discharge action against the captain after the dismissal was not adjudged. And I think the defense, again, was concerned that ultimately if you get to sentencing in this case, will this member be biased in favor of a dismissal because of the fact that he initiated discharge action against this captain who did not get a dismissal.
The defense counsel did not use the peremptory challenge on either of the two individuals that you're now discussing. How does that play into this evaluation or analysis?
It strikes me as problematic, Your Honor. However, I would note that the government in their brief, in their answer to our assignment of errors, did not invoke waiver as a basis for denying relief.
But what about the RCU?
I cited the RCM. My position is that you only get one peremptory challenge in the military. So they couldn't have challenged both Colonel Peters and Colonel Andrus. So at least one of those challenges...
But is it reasonable if you take one, you still preserve your issue on the other?
That would seem to be what the rule says, Your Honor. But I can...
So how else are we supposed to read the rule then?
Let me say that I don't think the rule in that sense is perfectly clear. It seems to be, on the one hand, talking about a single challenge for cause and using a peremptory challenge, and the rule does not specifically address, if there are multiple challenges for cause, the failure... What happens then when you fail to use your peremptory challenge?
Is any of them or one?
Well, I'm saying...
It's pretty clear if you use one.
It's clear if you use one.
If you use one and an implied bias is denied, it's pretty clear what the rule is. It's preserved, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I guess what I'm saying is, to me, the rule is not clear if you have multiple challenges for cause denied and you don't use a peremptory challenge. Does the peremptory failure to use it only when one challenge for cause is denied or when multiple challenges for cause are denied? The rule, I think, could be more clear with respect to multiple challenges for cause. I don't know where my end time was. I thought a sign was going to come up. Okay, is that correct? Okay, so we have not. Okay, I'm sorry.
9 minutes.
I'm trying to keep track of this, and the system obviously is a little bit challenging. But I understand the rule. I think the rule should be more explicit in terms of saying when you have multiple challenges for cause, if you do not use a peremptory challenge, you lose the right, you waive all challenges on appeal. The rule doesn't explicitly state it that way.
Right.
And so because it doesn't explicitly state it that way, that's why I'm pressing the issue here.
Understand.
Now, unless there are any other questions on Colonel Andrus, I would like to go.
Yes. Okay, just to be clear.
I had 20 and 10.
Correct.
How long is the time?
20. Correct? That's what he was asking.
I thought a sign was going to come up saying your time is up.
It did. And that's why I asked the question.
My peripheral vision was as good as I could.
I saw that time.
Okay. I apologize, Your Honor. I deserve my main argument. And I'll take off.
No, just stop. You can still have your 10 at the end because of the misunderstanding. Did you have a brief summary? Did you want to use any 20 or did you want to use any of that?
No, I'll use my summary for the end of the rebuttal.
So this will count as your 20.
Right.
And then you still have 10.
Right.
All right.
Thank you, Your
Honor.
Chief Judge Orr, Judge Round, Judge Weiss, may it please the Court. I'm Major Daniel Brain, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, we represent the United States in this matter. In response to appellant's assignments of error, it's the government's position that, pursuant to Rule for Court Martial 912F4, appellant waived review of his denied challenges for cause when trial defense counsel did not use a peremptory challenge, that the sentence of dismissal was an appropriate punishment for appellant's crimes, and that trial counsel's arguments based on the evidence and reasonable inferences did not constitute prosecutorial misconduct. Now, first, I'd like to address the challenge for cause. And as I stated in the introduction, it is our position that this is waived. During the initial argument, it was described as problematic, but the rule reads, failure by the challenging party to execute a peremptory challenge against any member shall constitute waiver of further consideration of the challenge upon later review. The statements that he made about his confusion, whether there is that, if there's multiple challenges for cause, the rule could be clear. There's nothing in the law that supports that position. It is simply stated in the RCM that you need to execute a peremptory challenge in order to preserve it for review.
So the fact that he didn't, does that mean that both of those challenges are my advisor no longer right for this court?
Yes, Your Honor, that's our position.
So if he used one, the other one would have still existed, or perhaps both of them would still existed?
Yes, if he had used one against one member, then the other member would still existed. If he used a peremptory against any of the other panel members, then both of those issues would have existed.
For me, I would like you to go into the implied bias
okay.
issue.
Yes, Your Honor. Pursuant to United States versus Bagstad, implied bias exists when, regardless of an individual member's disclaim of bias, most people in the same position would be prejudiced. The test for determining a challenge for implied bias is objective, viewed through the eyes of the public, focusing on the appearance of fairness. However, also it was noted that the hypothetical public person is assumed to be familiar with the military justice system. Now, just to bleed over the waiver issue a little bit, just in terms of how the public would view this, if you don't use a peremptory challenge on any of the members, that's kind of a signal that you're happy with the panel. So I think that in terms of looking at the implied bias, I think that's an important factor to take into consideration. They didn't use the peremptory challenge.
Or they were just thinking the numbers were more important than the challenge.
And that could very well be. And that may have been the whole reason why we have the waiver issue in the first place, is they were happy with the numbers. The panel wasn't that bad. But if these individuals were so bad, then the numbers issue wouldn't be important. If they were going to have that much of an effect on the panel, they wouldn't even consider the numbers issue. I've got to get this guy off my panel. They would have used one of the peremptory challenges.
Then why challenge with them? If they were happy with the numbers, why challenge them for implied bias at all?
Well, they challenged three people, and they were going to challenge four. They actually could have maybe got the numbers down to five. I don't know what the trial defense counsel's plan was, if he was trying to use the two challenges on these additional people to get the numbers from seven to five, and then he could have used the peremptory to bust the panel, or he could have been happy with five. If people use charts for those determinations of how it affects them, sometimes the numbers play an important role. Now, in terms of Colonel Peters and looking at the Alpha Yumi case, which is important, Judge Weiss pointed out that the judge went into great detail regarding this issue. In fact, he asked the questions, and he asked them in individual voir dire, recognizing that it was important in order to get out the correct answers for him to be able to judge actual implied bias. Now, an individual in this case that has been mentioned yet is Colonel Smiedendorf's. And he's important because when he was questioned by the judge, he said that he had a strongly held belief, and he also indicated that it could have some effect on his determination of a proper sentence. And that's important because you can contrast that with Colonel Peters, who stated that although he had thoughts of a religious nature about homosexuality, Colonel Peters unequivocally stated it was important to separate the belief from the individual, that his job was to follow the law and not to interject his personal belief into the process or system, and ultimately he could be fair with the evidence presented. And that's in the record on pages 157 through 153. And that's important because this wasn't the judge asking these questions. He was volunteering these sentences. He wasn't just answering yes or no to those questions. He showed a strong indication that he would follow the law and that he understood his role. Now, the next part that the appellant raised as a potential basis for implied bias was the prior administrative discharge board that Colonel Peters was on, and the fact that they had a recommendation that was ultimately overturned. However, that's all the information we have. The the standard that was presented during the first argument was that he didn't disavow the decision, as if that would, was the burden was on the member in order to rehabilitate himself. However, consistent with United States versus Vanworth, when someone has been involved in a administrative discharge board, the burden is going to be on the appellant to ask questions to determine if there is bias. So here there were no follow-up questions. He didn't ask him if he agreed with the convening authority's determination, if he was upset with it, if there was anything about the process that he felt could impact him, if there was anything at all that would impact his ability to be a fair and partial juror in this case. He just merely got out that he was involved in a case, and Colonel Peters volunteered that the ultimate decision was overturned by a higher authority. So there's nothing in the record that indicates that Colonel Peters had a bias in any way or could not sit impartially. And I believe a member of the public would agree.
Okay, counsel, viewing it from the eyes of somebody in the public, here you go. The military judge at the outset sets up the voir dire with the premise that the allegations of sexual conduct between males and some people have very strong feelings about homosexual conduct. So automatically, the military judge acknowledges that these strong feelings. The member admits having moral and religious beliefs, which I would assume you would agree would be, are strongly held beliefs because of their, because it's based in religious faith.
That's okay? Correct.
So you have that, and even though initially, did he not basically somewhat qualify his answer by saying, I think, and then later he becomes more certain as he's quizzed on these matters?
Well, Your Honor, on the record on page 147, where the first I think comment came out, the exact quote is when he was asked if he had strong beliefs that would impact his ability to sit fairly. His response was, I do not, period. But then he went on to explain, I have thoughts and beliefs of a religious nature about homosexuality, but I don't think it will negatively impact the ability to be fair and reasonable and, you know, make a decision based on the case, based on the evidence. Now, the use of I think, it wasn't just a, can you do it, I think. You've got Colonel Peters has been intelligently providing information knowing that it's of interest. This was important to him to project it to all of the parties that there how he was going to be able to sit and his understanding that he needs to separate himself and his individual beliefs in the law.
Okay, well, let's say the member of the public says, okay, this member has this religious belief and is disclaiming that it can't be fair. But then when you add, as Mr. Spinner is wanting to do, to distinguish it between the Alpha Mooney case, is the discharge board. Now, the member of the public isn't going to know all the ins and outs of a discharge board. They're going to say this person sat on a board that voted to discharge based on homosexual statements, and the decision was later reversed. Don't you think that would possibly tilt the balance in some way as far as distinguishing it from Alpha Mooney?
I think it could tip the balance if there was more information. The mere fact that he was on a discharge, there's no information about what that discharge board, the evidence that was there. I think if the evidence didn't have, well, there was no reasonable basis to support a recommendation of discharge, then there may have been some concerns in a member of public that, hey, this guy's not going to live, that he's got some sort of filter that he's using here. But there's no information of that. We just have the bare bones. He was on a panel. They recommended discharge. But you've got his strong, unequivocal statements about what he knows his role is and how he has to apply the law when he's doing his deliberations. Now, in terms of Lieutenant Colonel Andrus, Mr. Spinner has already stated that the doctor issue isn't as important an issue, and consistent with the United States versus Abando Moran, there's no set criteria that just because somebody's a doctor that they're unable to be impartial and listen to and evaluate testimony. Also in that case, there was going to be expert testimony that he's familiar with. Here, we didn't have any doctor expert testimony. Now, moving on to the case that he preferred in the discharge, I think what you see here is, and the reason why he was called back is, he has a lot of fuzzy memory about this instance. Repeatedly during the inquiry, he informed the parties that they could check with the legal office, or if he looked at the records, he could familiarize himself with it more. He just doesn't remember it, which is a strong indication that it wasn't very important to him. Now, the subject of candor was raised in argument. However, there were no follow-up questions in terms of the candor element of it, where you would be perceiving that he was lying about it. As a matter of fact, the judge made a finding when he was looking at actual bias that he wouldn't expect a commander to remember everything that he's done, and that it, for something that happened 1.5 to 2 years ago, this was not unreasonable. As a matter of fact, we don't have in the record, because no one followed up on it, any discussion about how many different discharge boards he was involved in, how many different charges has he preferred, how many Article 15s has he's given. So the strong indication here is that this that it was just not important to him at all. If the case was so significant to him earlier, I think he would have had probably a better memory of it.
Or he's interested in a point that he's trying to help with. And that, to be honest with you, without too many commanders or referring charges, then discharge boards for one of their officers is just not that common.
Right.
It wouldn't be continuous to say he wouldn't remember one of his officers being brought up with charges, personal opinion, but that's pretty much all.
Well, Judge Ryan, I think really the fuzziness in this was he didn't remember how the guy was discharged. He knew what the charges were. He knew that the individual spent some time in jail, and he knew that the person was discharged, but he thought it was due to the court-martial. He just couldn't remember the fact that it was an admin discharge. And I think that's why the military judge used the term ministerial, because the military judge was making his determination that this was just not a very important issue to Lieutenant Colonel Andrus, so therefore he was really forming more of a ministerial role as he was processing it. Well, Your Honor, it's a standard that's lower than abuse of discretion, but higher than de novo. So it's in that public perception sweet spot in the middle, where you give some deference to what the judge made rulings on. As a matter of fact, you give more deference the more detailed the judge is when he gives his explanation of why he refused to grant the challenges. And the military judge here went into detail describing what he was looking at, how it impacted him, and also he let everyone know that in both cases he applied the liberal grant mandate.
Don't you think that a member of the public might think that this particular party had a strike against him? And I'm thinking more towards sentencing, that once they were convinced that some type of homosexual act had occurred, whether it was forcible or consensual, that once you got into sentencing, then he would already have personal
bias,
animosity toward homosexual conduct. How did he get a fair sense of hearing under that situation?
Well, Judge Arnold, I wouldn't characterize it as an animosity because...
Well, I didn't mean... I wouldn't want to phrase it.
Yes, sir.
I mean, have a personal distaste for that conduct.
Well, people can have a personal distaste for lots of different kinds of conduct. It could involve drinking. There could be personal distaste about dancing. There's all sorts of issues that can come in, and that's why it's important for members.
He's basing some of his decisions on the religious teaching. It's a little different
right.
than personal opinion about whatever conduct. He's saying my personal opinion is based on my religious upbringing or
right.
teaching. So, I mean, there's a difference there as respect to everybody hates murder. So if you could address that, because I'm just looking from a public perception standpoint, is there an issue with respect to you already had a strike against him with that member who's now determined you engaged in some form of homosexual conduct, which I find to be a violation of my religious tenets?
Your Honor, I would characterize it as it would bring a concern. But it wouldn't necessarily be an automatic strike, or we would be in the situation where we would have per se rules that members can't sit in those situations.
But that wouldn't apply to bias. We're assuming that your personal disclaimer that you can do your job is not enough. And we look at it from the public's perception and say, we just don't know that you really can do it despite what you told us.
Well, Your Honor, consistent with LPA-UME and their finding, that if that was the position that the public would take in every instance, then in that case, there should have been a per se rule created. Because arguably then, any member of the public looking at this would never be able to see fairness if someone had religious beliefs on a particular issue that may be related to the character of an accused. And I think in this case, it was important to go into great enough detail so that you could assuage any of those concerns. And when someone is so forthcoming in how they can separate themselves as an individual from the law, how they understand that there's a difference between religious beliefs and what they do in the courtroom, it would be understandable. There are many people who have many religious beliefs that could impact how they perform their duties and their job. And they can separate it. I think people in the public understand that there's going to be lots of situations where people may be dealing with other people who are engaging in conduct that they don't approve in, but in a professional setting, they have to put that aside. So this would be a similar situation. Is that guy up there going to automatically punish him just because he feels that homosexuality is immoral? But when you look at it from the individual point of view, you can also argue, I as an individual feel that if I engage in homosexual conduct, that's immoral. What somebody else does is between them and their maker.
Is that what he said?
That's not what he said.
All he said was, is it against my religious beliefs?
Right, but if you're looking at it from a member of the public, through their knowledge of the ways of human nature and the ways of the world, have that understanding that there are people that have those views out there. It's a lot larger filter than something that should be closer to a per se rule.
Counsel, can you address the argument issue and the bolstering and facts not in evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. The standard review for alleged prosecutorial misconduct is de novo, and there's going to be two analyses that the court is going to have to go through in this matter, is whether there was an objection or no objection. If an objection is made, then the review is whether the trial counsel's misconduct impacted a substantial right of an accused. And absent an objection, an appellant must convince the court that trial counsel's argument was an error, the error was plain and obvious, and that it materially prejudiced substantial rights. In other words, the error must have been so significant as to influence the outcome of the trial. Now, this issue is a little difficult to argue at this point because in looking at appellant's brief, there are a lot of excised words, many of which are linked together by ellipses. And so, therefore, I just want to put forward, first of all, that when you're looking at arguments, they need to be viewed in the context of the entire court-martial. And further, consistent with United States versus Bayer, the words should not be viewed in isolation, but also in context with the entire argument. And also went on to say that's improper to surgically carve out a portion of argument with no regard to context. Now, just to give a general nature of this case, there was 4 days of trial before the members. The government's argument was 44 total pages, and there were 4 separate instructions by the military judge that arguments of counsel were not evidence, 2 of them in response to objections. The defense counsel also made a comment that what he was arguing was not to be considered evidence either. Also, what you're looking at when you're looking at the entire argument is you're not looking at a Fletcher situation. In Fletcher, when you look at the entire argument, you look at the tone of the argument. It was at times combative. There was substantial use of an I pronoun, which in this case, it needs to be noted that Trial counsel used it 22 times, and defense counsel used it 69 times. However, the difference between this case and Fletcher is, in Fletcher, she was putting herself into evidence by saying what she felt. And here, almost all of the I usages by all the counsel were, I want to point you to this, or it was in terms of hypothetical. It wasn't injecting the word I into their own personal belief about the evidence or the believability of a witness. Now, one of the points of appellant's brief was that counsel repeatedly commented on appellant's guilt. However, there were no record sites, and there was absolutely no discussion of what appellant feels were comments on appellant's guilt. Therefore, as I just discussed with the not using the words I, the trial counsel never said that she said, I feel he's guilty, or I know as a prosecutor he's guilty. The only thing I can think is that this is the application of argument to the elements, which, honestly, I would hope a trial counsel would do. I would hope that a trial counsel would argue to the members that the evidence meets the elements and the person's guilty. If they don't, then they shouldn't be there. And also, on that issue, I would like to note there was a lack of objection. There was no objection on that grounds. Now, the second issue in the brief was the analogy that trial counsel used regarding Airman Stanton placing her in the place of the purported victim. And in that case, what she did was she said, you've seen Airman Stanton, you've seen her size and how tall she is, and you see how much she weighs. Now imagine she's in the room with the accused, and she was essentially replaying the events of in the hotel room with this female. At which point the defense counsel, after some time, objected, and the trial judge said, look, I don't know where you're going with this. Stick to what's on the charge sheet. Eventually, what the trial counsel finally got to was the whole point of what she was using the analogy for, which was what she stated. She asked the members to consider whether they would change their mind if there was a female victim. And she did that twice, and both times she did that, there were no objections to when she characterized it that way. So it's interesting because this really isn't trying to inflame the passions of the members as one would think in a sexual assault case where maybe somebody would try and use that analogy to suggest there could be other victims or there could be worse circumstances. She was actually trying to deflame the members from having some sort of judgment against the purported victim based upon the fact that he was a raven, he had specialized training to defend himself, that he was male, that he was a weightlifting champion, all the things that defense trial went through during their cross-examination of witnesses and also in contribution to their theory that this was really more of a homosexual guilt situation. She didn't want them to be biased against males, which is why she used the analogy. So therefore, I would argue that the analogy was an error, and secondly, even if it was error, it was cured by the military judge when he told her to move on.
Let me ask you something, counsel. On
yes,
page 634 of the trial counsel's argument, is this bolstering when the trial counsel says they came in here, you saw how credible they were? Is that appear to be vouching for the credibility of the witnesses, her personally or the government personally vouching?
Well, when you're using the words, they came in here and you saw how credible they were, it's kind of telling the members, it's arguing to them, you saw how credible, that it's their determination when you use the word you, first off to that. And secondly, when she was going ahead, and this was in reference to the Ravens,
yes,
that she was testifying about.
Right.
First of all, what I would like to point out in terms of that, if you just look at it in terms of potential prejudice and then work backwards. When those members all came and testified, defense counsel never cross-examined them on the issue related to how upset the purported victim appeared after the alleged assault. The trial counsel mainly was going through those issues. Defense had that other issue. So in terms of prejudice, their believability really wasn't an issue in the case because trial counsel wanted to say they were upset. Defense said, sure, he was upset. It's because he's got homosexual guilt. And defense went through all the training that he had, and
trial counsel tried to use different analogies throughout their argument in order to deal with why you would have a male in that situation.
Okay, counsel, how about this one on page 656, referring to the victim, and you hear him quite clearly say, quote, "I never gave him permission to do that," meaning the accused, and then the trial counsel says, "Believe what he said happened, because all the additional evidence supports what he says and corroborates what he says." But believe what he said happened. Is that vouching? Is that the trial counsel improperly vouching for the witness?
I don't think it's improper vouching, because what she's calling for is for the members to believe it. She's imploring them to believe it. She didn't state, "I believe," or it's uncontroverted that.
Isn't there a reasonably an implied "I" there?
Not necessarily. No, if you're imploring someone to believe something, then you want them to have their mind made up. You're not necessarily. If you're going to have an implied "I" in that, you're going to have an implied "I" in everything that you're arguing. If you're going to argue that on any issue that you're going to try to find somebody guilty of, there is going to be some projection of "I" because you're there arguing, trying to convince the members to find somebody guilty. It's just becomes a situation where the person is doing so much personal vouching, like you saw in Fletcher, where when you look at it, you say to yourselves, okay, this may have affected the outcome of the trial. But imploring someone to believe something in the context of an entire argument doesn't reach that level.
Can you speak briefly to the common viewpoints that he lists out in his brief with respect to misrepresentation of evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. There were a few instances where appellant felt that the evidence was mischaracterized, but for the most part, these issues really weren't where there was a direct quote that was being used. It's a comment on the evidence. Now, for example, one of the issues that was raised was that Rogers said DiMatteo is a touchy-feely guy. And what the record shows at 635 is what was argued was, he being McPhillips explained, you know, I kind of thought he was a touchy-feely kind of guy. Master Sergeant Rogers told you the same thing. He's a high-five, down-to-earth kind of guy. Sure, I've given him high at fives. He's kind of a touchy-feely guy. Now, Rogers did not use the words touchy-feely guy. That is correct. But when you look at the context of his testimony, it's, "Sir, I would say Colonel DiMatteo from day one was very friendly and outgoing, very outgoing and friendly. And he told me from day one was that he never wanted to focus on the negative stuff, and he always wanted to look at the upside of things. He was of a let's work with people, and so I can recall him being a high-five type of person." That's a record at 576. In those type of situations, I think it would be reasonable to say that somebody is a touchy-feely kind of guy. So I don't think, and also on that particular issue, even if that one quote is considered error, how that would have impacted the trial is hard to understand. The only instance where there was an actual objection was when trial counsel argued McPhillips never said this was Air Force Inn's lotion. And then she went on to start explaining the forensic analysis when trial defense counsel jumped up and said, "I object to the to McPhillips' characterization of what he said about the lotion." Now, the testimony was, looked like the same ones you get in the billeting rooms. It was a small bottle in white color at 338. He believed it to be Air Force Inn's lotion at 390, and that's what it appeared to be, once again, Air Force Inn's lotion at 391. So, actually, that's not incorrect. He never did say that it was Air Force Inn's lotion. He said it appeared to be. So it's instances like that, and there was an objection made, and even though the objection was made, and that was probably correct argument based upon the fact he never said that, there was no objection to that. Your Honor, may I just briefly summarize?
Sure.
Your Honor, in consideration of appellant's assignments of error, it is the government's position that the issue in regards to implied bias was waived, that the sentence to dismissal was an appropriate punishment, and that the arguments were based on the evidence and reasonable inferences, and we respectfully request this court to affirm the findings of sentence approved in this case.
I would like to come, not go back to the problem, but get into this very last issue. And I have some citations in the record that reinforce our arguments that were not given in our brief, and we did not file a reply brief, but to show how the government was vouching for the credibility of the witnesses. And when you look at prejudice, in my mind, the best place to look is how did the government deal with this when in rebuttal? I mean, it's one thing to say that certain things in their opening, closing argument, the defense can certainly respond to those. But where real prejudice arises is when the government makes the rebuttal closing argument and there's no opportunity for the defense to stand up again and point out what the government has done. And so in that regard, the trial counsel said in rebuttal at page 716, line 1, "We believe in the scientific evidence." On page 718, at line 13, "I think the defense actually made our case." On page 720, "We wanted you to see." Line 19. Page 721, "We think it is important." At line 16. Then when you go to the very last two pages of her closing argument, pages 725 and 726. And part of this vouching for the government is making an attack on the defense. Trial counsel argues at line 8 on page 725, "So when given an opportunity to stop and think, instead of going through, you know, a line of questioning meant to trip him up, I'm giving him an opportunity to think." Again, it's making an attack on the defense counsel as though they have ill motives. A line of questioning, i.e. cross-examination, meant to trip them up. And really, cross-examination is meant to discover the truth. Then, at line 13, 12 and 13, trial counsel argues, "And he was asked when, before he sat here, this particular witness, I think it was the alleged victim, the complaining witness, did the defense prepare him and say, these are the things we want to know?" And at that point, the defense does object, and the judge sustains the objection. But, I mean, here we are in the final stages of the rebuttal, and the government, and when you add all the other points that we made in our brief, the government is still trying to disparage the defense and vouch for the credibility of their own witnesses. At the bottom, line 22, trial counsel, "But I would like you to think about at what point during the night." She's injecting herself into the argument. And then finally, on page 726, one of the last statements that she says to court members and why we're arguing there's prejudice in this instance, she's referring to the some of the scientific evidence. And corroboration, I'm sorry. She says that lines 3, 4, and 5, "That's the quality with respect to the evidence. And we ask you to look at all of it. Remember that the government brought this evidence." Again, vouching for the credibility of the evidence. And this, when they say the government brought this evidence, I think she's now referring to the scientific evidence, which was totally unhelpful to the government's case. The DNA evidence did not connect Colonel DiMaggio to any offense, and then when you look at this this whole issue of the Air Force lotion and lotion that may have been used, the government's own witness could not connect their chemical findings with the Air Force lotions. So here she is. She's sort of doing two things. One, she's saying, "We brought this evidence," even though it showed no connection whatsoever with my client. And then she's saying, "And the government brought this evidence, so we wouldn't have brought it unless it had some value or meant something, and you can rely upon it."
So why didn't the defense counsel object during this improper about him. And there were instances once or twice, but really, if it was that critical, why didn't the defense counsel request a recess, discuss it with the military judge, and ask that he instruct the trial counsel to refrain from such?
Well, I can't argue why they didn't do it.
Well, the fact that they didn't, so now we're going to plain error analysis.
But right, and in Fletcher, certainly the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces overturned an Air Force decision that affirmed a trial counsel's argument, and they used the plain error analysis. The reason that we believe this falls in line with Fletcher is because this is pervasive throughout her entire argument. And one of the problems that you face as a defense counsel when you do make an objection, particularly where you're saying there's no evidence to support what the trial counsel just said, is that the judge's instruction will just be to the members, counsel's argument is not evidence, you rely on your own memory as to what the evidence is. And so that's why we articulated in our brief the multiple occasions where trial counsel played fast and loose with the facts and brought this up, because even had the defense objected, it would have gone nowhere. The judge wouldn't say trial counsel's playing fast and loose with the facts. All the judge would do is say, remember what happened here. And in that regard, one of the there are 2 points I'd like to make. One with respect to the lotion. I mean, the complaining witness basically said, I believed it was the Air Force lotion, and he describes that it came in a little white container just like is found in the Air Force lodging. So this idea that she says, that the trial counsel says, the complaining witness did not say it was the Air Force lotion. I mean, he all but said it was the Air Force lotion. So again, that's the trial counsel, in my mind, intentionally distorting the evidence. I mean, it's not just a matter of it's not in the evidence. It's distorting the actual evidence that the members heard. And so making multiple objections at that point really serves no purpose, because the judge is not going to cure it anyway. Another point that I think is important to note has to do with the corroboration by Rogers. The reason that the trial counsel argued that Rogers said that he was touchy-feely is because she's trying at that point to corroborate what the complaining witness said. That's the point. She's not just trying to sort of characterize evidence. In the record, it shows us quotes that Rogers said touchy-feely. Why does she want Rogers saying touchy-feely? Because that's what the alleged victim said, was that Colonel DiMaggio was touchy-feely. And so that's the government appellate counsel gets up here and tries to minimize like that. Well, she just meant, you know, characterizing what the actual testimony was. Well, it's not so much his general opinion that Colonel DiMaggio was friendly or gave people high fives. She is intentionally putting words in Roger's mouth at that point as an attempt at corroboration that this is what Roger said, as though he used the exact same term that the alleged victim used. And again, the government tries to say, well, this was a four-day trial. Well, that's one of the problems with a four-day trial. This court has the verbatim transcript to look at to see what the witness actually said. The members in a four-day trial are having to rely on their memories or whatever notes that they might have made. And so this, in this case, that's why it's so damaging to the defense, because it is difficult to remember what was said. And why would a trial counsel get up and specifically mischaracterize or misquote a witness? Why would they do that? And to some degree, the defense counsel, I mean, I don't know how good their notes were in terms of what the witness actually said. But the benefit we have at the appellate level is we have the record now. And we can go back and see exactly what the trial counsel represents that the witness said, and we can see exactly how she mischaracterized it in her closing argument. In our brief, and this perhaps is a dereliction in my part that I would like to correct right now, and we focused in some part on when she used the, it was implicit that she was saying, the trial counsel, I believe, I think. But going back and reading and preparing for this argument, I found some additional places where she is referring to we. in addition to I, and I'm not sure these are cited in my brief, so I'm going to go through these right now. In her primary argument, I've already given these in the rebuttal, and I think my time is up, so... I will just summarize by saying there are multiple places the court can examine the record and see where she says I or we in the context in which it is said. And for these reasons, we are asking for relief from this court.
Thank you.
All right. I'd like to thank counsel for the arguments today, this morning and this afternoon. And there being no further business before this court, the court will be adjourned and we will render a decision for both cases in due course.
All rise.